Okay, let's begin. So all these sessions that we'll have on these great controversies in Jewish history, we'll find there are different aspects of the controversies, where the controversy is coming from within the Jewish world, from externally against the Jews or from internally. This one that we're going to address tonight is easily one of the most painful chapters in all of Jewish history. We are the generation post-Holocaust, so we generally see things in light of the Holocaust. And the Holocaust, because of the magnitude of its trauma and tragedy, dwarfed everything that came before it. But had it not been for the Holocaust, until the year 1900, without question, the greatest tragedy in Jewish history post-destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, for those 1800 years, without a question, the greatest tragedy and trauma was the Spanish Inquisition, the Inquisition of the destruction of the Jewish community in Spain and in Portugal. We are in this country for how long is the Jewish community settled here? 150 years, maybe 200 at best. And how rooted are we? How much do we feel a part of society? People are like, you can go to cemeteries and see 3 generations, 4 generations maybe. Those of us who came over after Europe are not yet there. 750 years the Spanish community existed. 750 years. There were 10, 11 generations in the local cemeteries of family plots. They were integrated into every aspect of Spanish life. They were the doctors and the lawyers and the politicians. They were involved in government. They were the financiers. They were on everything. 750 years, snuffed out. Literally not a Jew left practicing Judaism in the entire country of Spain, and then 5 years later in Portugal. And the degree, the numbers of those who were either killed, died along the way, converted, or lost everything. Again, if not for the Holocaust, numbers make everything else seem small. But had it not been for that, they always spoke. That was the greatest tragedy and trauma in Jewish history. Now, we are not allowed to judge others, obviously. So as we're going to be talking about this dark period in Jewish history, we are not here to judge those who did convert or did not convert and what happened. That's obvious. Doesn't need to be said. I'm going to say it anyway. But this trauma was because of what took place, what the Jews did, and then the reaction to them. What we're going to address tonight, Mirtz Hashem, is really going to be focused on two or three things. Number one is understanding that the event, if you say the word Spanish Inquisition, everybody says, what year am I talking about? Everybody knows that. But 1492 was simply the funeral. There's some sheets over here. The 1492 was the funeral of the Jewish people. This funeral, the death knell, which happened in 1492 with the expulsion, began 100 years later in 1391 with a massive pogrom. That entire 100-year history was a disaster for the Jewish people, and it really started 50 years before that. So we have to sort of see in context what was going on in Spain over those 150 years to really understand the context and background of what took place and how that will influence anti-Semitism that we are seeing still today in the world. Many scholars attributed the ability of the Holocaust to take place was based on what happens during that 100-year period from 1391 to 1492. And so we'll see the context of that. Number two is to really then understand why and how this unique period in Jewish history really had never seen, we never really seen anything like this before. Never in the history of Jewish people, never, not before and not since, has there been a failure of the Jewish spirit in the sense of mass conversion. Just never happened. There had always been individuals throughout history in different periods of time. But a mass of people measuring in the tens, if not hundreds of thousands of Jews to leave the faith and become Christian has never before been seen. But you have to, and when we see it in the context of what was going on, it'll give us a little bit more of an understanding. And obviously, not all of those converts were real converts. Many of them were just hiding, as we'll discuss at great length in a few moments. And that's going to lead us to the third period, or third aspect of our discussion, is after understanding the context. And then what happened is, in the years and centuries following this tragedy, as Jews who became Christians returned, the complication within the Jewish community as to how do we deal with those who left the fold and now want to come back. And we'll take a look at several hundred years of response of questions that were asked in Jewish communities as to how to deal with all of that. Okay, well, all that as a background, let's take a look at this complicated period, tragic period of Jewish history. I think it's fair to say almost any period of Jewish history that you look at will probably have the word tragic continued, partly because that's been our history. It's pretty sad. But we're at the end. We're at the end. We can see the light at the end of the tunnel, God willing. It's coming soon. Okay, a few points of historical background. Spain was reconquested by the Christians in around the year 800-810 it began, meaning the Muslims had come up from North Africa. They conquered Spain. They took over the entire Iberian Peninsula. And then the Christians came back down to reconquest Spain. So it's great to we're going to talk a lot about the Christians and the Muslims. Everything that we're going to be talking about is completely backwards from the way that it is today. And we'll acknowledge that as we go along in terms of who was in power and who was what as far as it goes. But the Muslims were not new to conquering and then being reconquered, as were the Christians. And it went back and forth. Once the Christians began their reconquest in the early 800s, it took about 400 to 500 years until they completed the task, until 1248 was when they finally made it and established a complete Christian country. The Jews entered Spain under the Muslims. They enter in from North Africa and elsewhere in this period of Jewish history, which is not far after the dispersion, after they were originally sent out of, after the second base of Mikdash. They stayed in a couple different areas, and then they began to spread out. They enter into Spain under the Muslims. Why is that important? Because the Muslims, again, this is a little bit backwards from today, they were the progressive ones. They were the ones into art and poetry and architecture and philosophy. They were the doctors. That was the culture that they had, and they had nothing against the Jews. The Christians felt the Jews killed their God, and the Christians were a superstitious, mostly illiterate group, but the Muslims were the progressive ones. And the Jews enter into Spain, into this world, and when the Christians eventually reconquer it with bringing back into their Eastern European superstition and approach to life, they inherit several hundred thousand Jews, who, as Rabbi Wein likes to call them, they were uppity Jews. They were Jews of philosophy and Jews of wealth and Jews of politics and Jews who were involved in government and everything. And all of a sudden, they were at great odds with the new conquering power, the Christians who were there. That will lead to, from the very beginning and get-go, a tremendous conflict, so to speak, a tension between the Jews that were there who were powerful and the Christians who were now actually running the country. Number two, the Inquisition. The Inquisition was not actually established to take out the Jews. It had nothing to do with the Jews. It was established several hundred years prior to 1492. We have the earliest records already in the late 1100s. It was actually established by the church to deal with Christians who were not observing Christian law as they were supposed to. It was already it was strengthened under Pope Gregory IX, who reigned from 1227 to 1241, and he authorized various Dominican friars as its agents. They began using torture, and by 1256, again, this is way before, 130 years before our Inquisition, 240 years, excuse me, before our Inquisition, there were already the concept of inquisitors who were given, they were a strong group. It will be recreated in 1492, but it already existed against Christians and Christian heretics. Just a couple of other points of background to understand what's going on. 1242, again, we're 250 years prior to 1492. King James I of Aragon issues an edict requiring all Jews to attend the conversionist sermons of Dominicans and Franciscans. This is 1242. It's put into law that the Christians are going to proselytize to the Jews. And you're going to now have to sit and listen to a radicalized friar who is going to teach that you are the devil, that you're going to hell, and that until you convert, or unless you convert and accept Christianity, there is no hope for you. They then began entering the synagogues. This became part of Jewish life in medieval Spain, that you would go to shul, and you would hear from the local friar who would come in and give a fire and brimstone sermon. Many scholars believe that this is the idea of the drasha, which became part of Jewish life, had its origins in this. Because, like, why are we giving a drasha anyway? If you're coming to daven, you should come and daven. Then you go home. You have daven, kiddush, and go home. Why is there a drasha? Because you have to sit through through the friars' drasha first, so there became a problem. You would actually at some point get a drasha as well. This, of course, is a minig for not listening to anything that's said from the pulpit. Began here, this as well. But the minig of falling asleep during the drasha, that only came from the rabbis. Nobody fell asleep when the friar was there with all of his armed guards and entourage who came with him. That started much later. But this is just to paint a picture of what it was like. And we have a hard time imagining this in the general freedom that we have here in the United States, that you would be forced to listen to Sunday morning, TV, and they would like come into your, it was part of the curriculum in school, part of the shuls, and this is already in the mid 1200s. In 1263, the Jews were invited to participate in many debates with the Christians. The most famous, of course, was the Ramban with Pablo Christiani. Pablo Christiani was originally a Jew. He was a learned Jew. And as many learned Jews who left the faith, again, this is way before, because of the Inquisition, they felt that they knew. And they did, actually. They were well versed in Gemara and Judaism. And so he convinced King James that he would be able to disprove Judaism and prove Christianity from the Talmud itself. And so the king was very intrigued by that, and so he invites the Ramban to this famous debate. The Ramban wrote up his entire records of the debate, which we have. He agreed, the Ramban, on condition that he have the freedom to speak. And the king granted him that freedom, and the Ramban, of course, wiped the floor with Pablo Christiani. The king stopped the debate before it reached its conclusion. He was quoted as having said, "I've never seen anyone so nobly defend an incorrect cause," or like something along those lines. After the debate, the Ramban was forced to flee. He understood that had he stuck around, that would be the end of him. And that's when the Ramban makes his way to Eretz Yisrael. He lives out the last couple of years in his life in Eretz Yisrael, the end of the 1200s. He also famously, we'll get to the history of the Ramban. When he gets to Yerushalayim, he does not find a minyan. There is not a minyan of Jews in Yerushalayim at the time. He goes up to Tzfat, where there was a small pocket of Jews, and he brings back a few Jews back to Yerushalayim with him. He establishes what we have as the Ramban Shul, and that's where he lives out his life at the end, after he had to flee Spain after one of these debates. But again, in context, this is still way before the Inquisition. This is in the mid-1200s. Jews were invited and forced into all sorts of debates. Why does Pablo Christiani convert? Because it's a Christian country, and the Jews were not given freedoms. You could not become certain things. Could not have certain professions, money, all certain things were withheld. And so there were already Jews converting at this time. It wasn't a mass movement, but you certainly have them as evidence in all of these things. Just setting the time, moving forward about 100 years. So we're skipping a lot of time with a lot of important information, but just to set our context is the Black Death, the plague from the mid-1340s till 1353 or so. The numbers of the Black Plague are astounding in terms of the how many they estimate. Was it between like 30 and 40% of Europe was wiped out over the course? I forget the numbers. Is it 20 million? I forget the exact number. It was astounding how it swept through Europe. Why is it relevant to our discussion? Because the Jews were very clearly affected less so than the general population. Maybe knocked out like 20% of the Jewish population, but 40% of the general population. The reasons for that are fairly well known and obvious. Jews were more hygienic than their Christian neighbors at the time. They washed their hands every single time they woke up in the morning. They washed their hands before they ate bread. They buried their dead immediately. They showered once a week for Shabbos. That was a novelty. They showered once a week for Shabbos. And because you can't make a bracha or learn Torah in a putrid place, their shuls and homes were generally, I mean, we would probably be disgusted, going back. But in that era, their homes and shuls were cleaner and more sanitary because of all of these halachas than the general population. And because of that, but not everybody understood why that would have any impact, but because of that, their numbers were a little bit less affected, and they were always mumbling, davening, making brachas. So, the famous poisoning the well, all sorts of different things came up, and that created, in this context, pogroms throughout Europe. And by 1351, there were 60 major and 150 smaller Jewish communities completely destroyed by pogroms. We're talking about an era where there's no protection from the police, there's no protection from the local government. If a band of who knows what would sweep through your little shtetl, that was the end. The shtetl was murdered, and there was nobody left. And there were 200 200 Jewish communities post Black Death, and then now in the mid 1300s, that were just simply wiped out. On the heels of the Black Plague, back into Spain, there was a civil war for the throne of Castile between two brothers. Henry II murdered his brother Pedro the Cruel. You do not want to know why somebody would get such a nickname. Despite the fact that the Jews generally supported Pedro the Cruel, but Henry had promised, he ran on a campaign that he was going to get rid of all of the Jews from positions of power. And not that there was a vote, but the local population supported Henry II on this platform of getting rid of the Jews. But after he gets into power, he realizes that he sort of needs all the Jews, and that just created a tremendous amount of anger in the population. Last little point of background, just to set up how bad it was in the last 100 years of Spain leading into 1391, Ferran Martinez becomes a ferocious preacher of anti-Jewish sermons, identifying the Jews as the obstacles for all problems in Spain. Now, this is sort of reminiscent of this fellow of Hitler, Yamach Shema, like a guy who stands up on a soapbox and yells and screams and yells and screams. And most of the time, everybody just like walks by and ignores him. But for 12 years, he's like traveling the countryside, yelling and screaming that the Jews are the problem. The Jews are the problem to all wealth. The Jews are the problem to all of our health. And eventually, if you preach for long enough, you get a disgruntled group of people who will follow you. And he gets a following. In 1390, after literally 12 years of this, the king and the archbishop, who really were holding things together, they both die in the same year. And their death and the vacuum of power from the king and the archbishop and this fellow who's going around preaching, literally over the last half centuries from the Black Death until now, like 50 years of anger explode in 1391. June 6, 1391 is identified as the first terrifying date in the Judeo-Spanish calendar, and pogroms spread throughout Spain and 50,000 Jews are slaughtered. 50,000 Jews throughout Spain. This is, again, after we briefly ran through about 100 years of history, but it was 100 years of anti-Jewish sentiment when it exploded. Pogroms, 50. Now remember, there are no bombs, there are no machine guns, there are no gas chambers. 50,000 Jews being slaughtered means there were 50,000 swords plundered into the bodies of 50. That's the only way that it was done. 50,000 people in a very short amount of time. It legitimized the concept of organized violence. Like, that's the way that it went. Like, you lived in Spain and you were subject to this kind of life. By the end of 1412, pogroms, the entire Jewish Spain is in shambles. All of this, a fellow John Carroll wrote a wonderful book called Constantine's Sword. He is a very controversial figure in the Christian world. He's a Christian because his book, it does not portray the church in a very positive light, but it's an amazing read. He was very well researched about what went on and a lot of the history of the church and the church-Jewish relationship. And he is a source of many of my pieces of information. He quotes that in 1414, after, again, this is like decades of problems, the Spaniards invited 14 community rabbis to a debate, and 12 of the 14 rabbis just converted on the spot. It was such a dead end of life in Spain that that was it. They just literally converted. Okay, all of this to set up our actual story. So we're now in the late 1300s, 1391. This pogrom I mentioned breaks out, and 50,000 Jews are slaughtered, and the church has lost control. This is just not a society. So the church came up with a solution in 1391. And that is, they said that if you will convert, until now, they were not interested in necessarily, they were just killing the Jews. The Jews were the problem, got to get rid of them. They came up with the idea that if you convert, you will not only be safe from these pogroms, but we, the church, will protect you. We'll protect you. And that was a way to try to regain control of a society that had sort of lost its bearings. Beginning in that year, 1391, it's estimated tens of thousands of Jews flocked, top of page 2 we're holding now, to the baptismal fonts. By 1425, 30 years later, it's estimated, some historians, that close to 200,000 Jews convert. which is between a third and half of the Jewish population. We're talking after 100 years of trauma, actual trauma. We have numbers of 200. Rabbi Wines writes in his lecture, he says, there's no way it was 200,000. He says, that's grossly over. Let's say it's 100,000. A quarter of the Jewish population, in numbers that were beyond imagination, had run to convert in a never before or since seen phenomenon, and it affected every single class of the Jewish community, from the rich to the poor, the scholarly, the ignorant, those who were notable, common. There was nobody immune to this mass. This, again, we're not talking 1492, this is 100 years prior. This is 1391, after almost 100 years of horror. The church says, we'll protect you, and there's a mass run to become Christian. Now, this is not our people. This is not the way of our history. We're a people of martyrs, not martyrs the way they throw them around today where you kill other people to be killed, but martyrs are people who die for Judaism. And, you know, we could reference the, I put it on the back sheet, so we're a couple nights from Hanukkah, the story of Hanukkah, the book of the Maccabees recalls that seven of her children were forced to bow down to an idol, and each one of the seven dies in front of her. Like, that's the people that we are, from Avram Avinu all the way through. And so many scholars have tried to figure out, like, what happened? How did this come about, that there was such a mass movement of conversion? So John Carroll offers two explanations in his book. Number one, he says, all of the influence had an impact. After 100 years, generation after generation after generation after generation, they were influenced, particularly, he writes, because, that's the Christian preaching. In addition to that, he writes, at the time, the rationalism that was sweeping through Europe changed from a religious group to a rational group, and an irrational group, so, you know, the people didn't have the same fervor in general, and it affected the Jewish community. Rav Yosef Yaivitz, who was exiled himself, he blames it on the fact that philosophy became the primary Jewish approach rather than just learning, just do. Everyone became a philosopher. So he said, listen, if you're a philosopher, and they put the sword to your neck, so you throw philosophy out and you do whatever you need to do to survive. But the deep-seated concept of emuna pshuta, had been lost. Rabbi Wein himself suggests that Kabbalah had began to take hold throughout the world, which we'll get to in various other forms over the year. And the messianic fervor that created, and the constant disappointment. I mentioned this, I think it was on Sunday morning. You know, we live in an era now, like we're going through a very difficult time in Jewish history. But we all intuit, whether we say it out loud or we don't, we're of that group or we're not of that group, we intuit, you know, Mashiach is around the corner. You know, whether or not we intuit it. You know, some people like to talk about it. Some people don't like to talk about it. I don't want to talk about it. I don't know. But whether we say it or not, but it happens to be half of the world Jewish population has returned to the land of Israel. We have a homeland. It's there. The light's at the end of the tunnel. I don't know if it's going to be this year or next year or in 10 years or 100 years. But if a Jew is going through a very difficult era right now, but you see Jewish history moving towards redemption, right? We're on a path that's like very obvious. I don't know how and when it will go, but that we're on a path, it's clear. If you were a Jew living in 1230 in Spain, and a horrible pogrom just killed your family, or 1260, or 1310, or 1370, what do you say to yourself? Is there any movement? Is there a light that's getting closer at the end of that tunnel? It's just bleak. There's nothing happening that will, and then 1400, and then, so this, the, when Kabbalah started, it tried, it like sprouted this hope that was then crushed over and over again. So that also has, as to part of this, this idea of those who left in great numbers. But lastly, and very most importantly, of these numbers, a great number of them never actually intended on converting. We have these massive numbers of Jews becoming Christians. Who knows what the percentage is, but besides, some of them actually did. And many, for sure, did not. And we know that many did not. The Rambam, who's not talking about Christianity, the Rambam was asked a similar question from somebody who lived in an Arab land and was being forced to pronounce the Mohammedan confession, to become an Arab. and his life was at stake. And so he sent a question to the Rambam that if it comes to this, and they're going to either make me accept Muhammad as a prophet or be killed, what should I do? Now, there's a different question than Christianity, because Islam is very different. They don't have the same type of idolatrous practices that Catholicism certainly does. So the Rambam said in the second paragraph there in the box, the Rambam says, for sure, one question. If somebody would ask me, should I die or profess my belief in Muhammad, my answer would be, utter the formula to live. A Jew has to live, 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 live. To be sure, don't live in that environment. And the moment you have a chance to get out, that's what you should do. Say what you need to live, and then tomorrow, pack up your bags and get out of town. And the Rambam writes explicitly, right? Inside your home, you maintain your identity. Outside, do what you need to do. And then as soon as you have the chance to get out of the country, get out of the country. Now, that's the Rambam on Islam, which is different. So the Jews in Spain were forced with the same issue on Christianity, where under more circumstances, whether Rambam would say to do the same thing, it's not clear. But the Jew himself, faced with the choice of a bleak life, of pogrom, after forced sermons for 100 years, living in a way that there was no future, so many simply said, this is just, the church will protect me. I just watched 50,000 Jews be slaughtered over a several month period throughout Spain. Just do what you need to do to live. And we'll continue practicing in private, and we'll figure that out. This is the late 1300s. So whatever the reasons of the conversion, those who actually converted, those who are just trying to survive, what we now have is a significant new group of society that arose that nobody knew what to do with. Because this group of Jews, imagine this in mass. Let's just take ourselves as an example. We're a shul, we're a large shul, 450 families. Can you imagine if 100 Christians showed up on the same Shabbos and said, we're now Jewish? And they came to all the minyanim. Imagine 200 of them came. And you're trying to run a minyan, let's say in this room, which normally has, whatever it is, 100 people. And now there's 75 Christians who don't know the first thing about anything show up and say, we're Jewish. And you try to figure out what to do with them. So at first you're like, big success. We have all these new people. And then you discover how complicated this scenario is when you have literally the number somewhere between 100 and 200,000 flood Spain of Jews who say, I can't live as a Jew. I'm going to become a Christian. And what very quickly happened is we now have three groups of Jews that exist in society. You have the Jew who stays true to his tradition, who is now being slaughtered, pogromed, finances are shambles, his life is in shambles, but he's holding true to his faith. You have the Jew who is left, who became a Christian and is a frum Christian, doing his thing. Moved his whole family over, put the kids in school, the works. And then you have a third group who, on the outside, says we're Christian to protect their home and their business and their finances. And on the inside is whispering to their old Jewish friends, we're still with you. We're like you. This middle group, the Jews who stay true to their faith, you left. You're sending your kids to Sunday school. You go to church. You don't come to Mass on Shabbat. We don't want you. The Christians very quickly realize, they're like, I don't understand what's going on over here. Because all of a sudden you have all of these Jews, but they're like walking to birthday parties on Shabbos. They all of a sudden became vegetarian. They're not involved in, they don't know, and they don't seem to want. I mean, we could do a comedy scene, but can you imagine if there'd be a group of five guys who showed up in church? Like what that would look like. Like these five Jewish guys sitting in the back row, you know, trying to figure out like what they're doing, trying to pretend to get it. Yeah, you're right. Like wearing the baseball game, right? Like, and the Christians are like, you're not really. But they said, we converted. And they kept their businesses. And this group is not liked by anyone. They're not accepted by their Jewish brethren, and they're not yet accepted by the Christian brethren. And you now have this new phenomenon. You had a guy named Yaakov, who the Christians hated, who was wealthy, was a business owner, who becomes one, who is still wealthy, who is still a business owner, and is now still hated. But he sort of converted. And this creates a massive problem for the church. The church is not ready to deal. They thought they had this great success. We got 100,000 Jews, 200,000 Jews. But there's no way. And think about this as well. Once the numbers, if we could use our example, if 10 Christians would, when 10 Jews converted, you can keep track of them. When 100, gets a little bit more complicated. What happens when that number tipped the scales and there were now 30,000 Jews who converted? 50,000, 75,000. So a Jew shows up, signs his name on a piece of paper, gets some water sprinkled on him. It's like, how are they going to keep track of me? How does the church know where I am and what I'm doing? There's 75,000. There are 100,000 Jews now in Spain. They're going to know whether or not I'm keeping Shabbos or I'm not keeping Shabbos. And so you now have this phenomenon of many Jews who once that tipped over, you can imagine the first Jews to decide to become Christian, not become Christian. But like once there's 75,000 other Jews who are doing it, you could just see why the numbers then just increase, because it's just a way to survive. It's a way to keep your business. Why should you lose everything for that? So the Christians who did not appreciate this started defining the difference between pure Christians and these old or pure Christians and these fake pseudo-Jewish Christians. And this, John Carroll argues, as do others, is the origin of the anti-Semitism that we know and hate. Because until now, when a Christian hated a Jew, why did the Christian hate the Jew?
Christ.
Exactly. There was a philosophical problem with what you believe and what your people did. And that had been 1,000 years of anti-Semitism from the year zero, so to speak, whenever they believe exactly he was born, which we don't know exactly when that is historically, but doesn't matter for our purposes. You are the Christ killers. And therefore, your existence as a Jew blasphemes God. I have a quote here from on the top of the page. Wherever the Christ killers gather, the cross is ridiculed, God is blasphemed, the Father is unacknowledged, the Son is insulted, the grace of the Spirit is rejected. Like, if the Jewish rites are holy and venerable, then our way of life must be false. But if our way is true, which it is, he claimed, then theirs is wrong. So why do we hate you? Because you are the antithesis of everything we stand for. Well, what happens when that Jew converts and now says, does, and acts, and believes everything that you do? But you still hate him. That created, for the first time, that the Jewish race is inferior. I hate you because you're a Jew, even though you believe what I believe. And you act and dress the way I do. You're still the Antichrist. But not even a religious thing. I don't want you part of my community. And that is the first time that it went from just the fact that you did something that makes you hate you, to there's something about you intrinsically as a race that is inferior.
Because it's that sincere?
Because even if it was, and they didn't know how to distinguish between the sincere, but even a Jew who was sincere, they still didn't want, you know, it's like as we would. You know, that we have a difficult time. We'll put this into context, right? When a Christian converts, so he converts. Let's say he and his wife both convert, and they have a child. And then that child wants a shidduch. There's a reality, even though in halacha, there's no question. There's a reality that it's like, you know, tell that to every family that, like, you know, there's a v'ahavtem ger. There's no question. But let's say you doubted the sincerity of this Christian family converting. For whatever reason, they both converted, they have some children, they came into the community, and there was just something that made people suspicious that they were doing it because of some reason, whatever it was, but not really sincere. And then that child wanted a shidduch. In the context of you were suspicious of their conversion, it's hard for us to imagine that child would have a hard time finding a shidduch. If there was a doubt in when there's no doubt in the sincerity as a culture, sometimes it's hard. If there is a doubt, so now I have a whole community of Jews who became Christian, and the Christians themselves didn't want them. The Christian community themselves said, you're not pure. And this created an entirely new race-based anti-Semitism. The second quote on this page from Brown University historian David Kurtzner writes that when they opened the archives of the Inquisition, and he writes, the explanation of what made the Holocaust possible is found in no small part in the files of the Inquisition. Those documents will deepen our knowledge for how, for centuries, the Roman Catholic Church conditioned the European population to view the Jews as inferiors. That started from the success of the church in getting everybody to convert, and then needing a new reason to hate them, even after they became Christian, because you're inferior. Your blood, I don't want Jewish blood. And this is now going to give rise to the Inquisition, because now we have an entire population of Jews. Let me just go back to one thing that I skipped earlier. The term Marano, this idea of a Jew who converted but is still practicing, is a very derogatory term. That's not the politically correct term. It's a well-known term. It actually is translated as to swine or pig. Historically, we do not know who named the Maranos. We don't know if it was the Christians who named the Jews the Maranos because they pretended to convert and they really suspected that they didn't, or it was the Jews who named the Jews who left the Maranos. But it's a very derogatory term. It's not the politically correct term. Conversos is the more correct term. Anusim is mean those who were by force, forced to convert. But it's worth just noting that. Okay, this brings us to this last, again, just historically, we're like sort of skimming over it. Nearly 50 years from 1391, the pogrom is when the first wave of conversions happened. For the next 40, 50 years, you now have this phenomena of Jews converting, some being sincere, some being not sincere, and trying to figure out who is who, with this group not really integrating into either side. Try to imagine, again, just like putting ourselves like into this boat, try to imagine like where you sort of feel like you have to, like I don't have a choice, like I got to live, how am I going to support my family, how am I going to make a living? And then trying to raise a family in secret of how to handle externally being Christian and internally being a Jew and trying to convey that to children. How many generations does that last in which you can somehow still convey a real authentic Judaism when you can't practice it on the outside and you have to teach the children to be secretive about it, those you can't speak to, those you can't speak to about it? It created quite a complicated dynamic. In 1469, I'm skipping ahead still several generations now, Ferdinand and Isabella marry, they unite Aragon and Castile, and they create the Catholic monarchy, and they set out as a state policy to get rid of this Jewish crypto problem. So they establish in 1482, 90 years after the first mass conversions, 90 years later, the Inquisition to be targeting those Christians who converted, but they suspected were still being Jewish. And that's under the authority of Thomas de Torquemada. And for 12 years, he prosecutes conversion with untold cruelty. So now when we normally just talk about the Spanish Inquisition, we talk about 1492 and maybe the 10 years prior. But again, it was 100 years, if not 150 years prior to that, that we had this issue. And in the quote of, again, John Carroll, the savagery of the onslaught against the conversos was without equal in the history of any tribunal in the Western world. Literally no one was safe. You don't know who you could talk to. Anything you said, you didn't know who was listening in, and you don't know who was going to report on you. It's like the KGB on steroids of being in a community in which people were disappearing in the middle of the night. Anyone who was once a Christian was subject to, if he was, you know, we have traditions that date to some of these periods of time, like Cholent. So I'm not joking. Cholent is, what's the idea of Cholent? Cholent is having hot food on, as having hot food on Shabbos. So the idea of still maintaining certain practices, like Jewish, like being able to keep hot food, like you know, Yom Kippur, Shabbos, the conversos were trying their best to maintain some form of Shabbos. The Rishonim speak very strongly about making sure you had hot food on Shabbos, because there are those who would, in order not to be caught. You know, there's like a lot of just historical, you know, how would you have to handle themselves on Yom Kippur? In order to prove your Christianity during these 12 years particularly, you have to prove yourself being a Christian. So you have to do certain things on Shabbos and on Yom Kippur to prove that you're a true Christian. We're going to see the ramifications of this will reverberate throughout Jewish history about all of these Jews for not just 1 year, 2 years. This is a 100-year period of time in where things were pretty bad. Anyway, the last 12 years was an untold cruelty, as I mentioned, in terms of prosecuting. But again, the main prosecutions were against those who actually converted, but they suspected were not actually observing Christian law. And eventually turned to prosecuting Jews who never claimed to convert. All of this led up to the decree in 1492, which we are all familiar with, either convert or leave. That's your choice. We'll kill you. If you stay, you can convert or you can leave. Those are the basic three choices that the Jews had. There were about 400,000 Jews left in the land at the time, and they estimate about half left. 200,000 Jews left, and the other 200,000 converted. So this is on top of the about 100,000 that had converted 100 years prior, and this is the end of 750 years of Jewish history in the land of Spain. By the last 300 were pretty brutal, but by the end, literally, there is not a Jew left who's practicing Judaism in the entire land of Spain. Just two famous figures, Don Abraham Sr. and Don Isaac Abarbanel, went their two separate ways. Abraham Sr., who was about 80 years old in 1492, was one of the most prominent Jews in the entire land, was very high up in the government, very wealthy person. At 80 years old, he said, "I'm too old to leave. I'm staying," and he converted. And the church made him do it in a massive show because he was literally like one of the most prominent Jews in the land. So they made a whole big show of it. And he converted, and you could look him up online. He has all sorts of progeny. Some of his descendants are very famous Catholics, and some returned back to Judaism. But Don Abraham Sr. is one of the most senior, if you'll excuse the pun, Jewish members who converted during this time. And Don Isaac Abarbanel wrote a very famous commentary on Tanakh, left penniless. When they said leave, convert, or die, it wasn't leave with your goods. You literally left penniless. I want to read to you, if you flip to the back page, the final one, the eyewitness account of what this was like when they left. But even before we read it for a second, just think for a moment, like take our community and the prices of houses, as you all know, which are like ridiculous. And imagine there'd be an edict that everyone had to leave. And you have to sell your house or your business. But everybody knew, all your Christian neighbors, we don't have so many here, but those who were here, like, you're gone in 3 weeks. They're going to kill you or you're leaving. You, like, you pack up what you have and that's it. This is an eyewitness account. Within the terms fixed by the edict of expulsion, the Jews sold and disposed of their property for a mere nothing. They went about asking Christians to buy and found no buyers. Fine houses and estates were sold for trifles. A house was exchanged for a mule and a vineyard given for a little cloth or linen. The rich Jews paid the expenses of the departure of the poor, practicing toward each other the greatest charity, so that except for a very few of the poorest, they would not become converts. In this first week in July, of course, what was the day of the actual expulsion? Everybody knows? Literally Tisha B'Av. This first week of July, they took the hardship of the road upon themselves and left the land of their birth, children and adults, old people and youngsters on foot, gentlemen mounted on donkeys and other animals in carts. They continued their journey, each one to the ports to which they had to go, and they went along the roads and through the fields with great travail and misfortune, some falling, others rising, some dying, others being born, others falling ill, so that there was not even a Christian who did not feel sorry for them. And always, through wherever they passed, the Jews were invited to be baptized. And some, because of the hardship, converted and remained. But those were very few. The rabbis strengthened their resolve and made the women and young people play on pipes and tambourines to cheer the people. And thus they left Castile and arrived at the ports of the sea. Literally, we have records of them playing music on Tisha B'Av on their way out. It's hard to imagine. Remember, Spain's a big country. They have to get to a port. So the people who live in the port cities was pretty easy. But everybody else inland, you have this massive migration just to get to the ports. Rabbi Wein says the estimated 50,000 Jews died along the way, just on the roads to get from wherever they lived, just trying to get to a port. Penniless, leaving everything behind. And obviously the young and the old, not everybody made it. Not everybody made it. That's Tisha B'Av, 1492. And again, that's just the death, as I said before. That's the funeral of the Jewish community, which really had ended way before. Okay, 200,000 leave, 200,000 convert and remain. So we now have all of these Jews who converted and remain in Spain. The rest have left. The majority went to Portugal, but that only lasted a few years because in 1497, the Portuguese kicked out all of the Jews. You remember, of course, in 1290, the Jews were kicked out of England, and in 1310, they were kicked out of France. We are Jews who think that, like, we'll be here forever in America, like, don't know Jewish history. Like, there has not been a country that we had been very well settled in that did not at some point kick us out. That's the story of Jewish people. I'm like, oh, we're so settled here. Spain ended. Judenrein. There was not a Yid practicing Judaism in Spain after 750 years. And they went all over the globe. Where do they mostly go? To the Muslim world. Why did they go to the Muslim world? Because in the Muslim world, you could practice your Judaism freely. If they would go to a Christian world, that's where they were just kicked out of. It's so backwards. The world turns in such an amazing way. So in the 1400s, the Sephardic Jews kicked out of Spain all go to Muslim countries because they left a Christian country, which had been a disaster to them, to go to a Muslim country because the Muslims treated them fairly well. They end up all over the new Ottoman Empire, Holland, Italy, Israel. We'll see the Jews who come to Israel. There was a movement of those Jews who made their way to Israel after this this trauma, this Holocaust of sorts, had its own as aspect. Okay, a couple last points before we get to our Ashaz. We'll conclude with that. The Inquisition continues for 300 years. The nation of Portugal and Spain do not formally abolish the Inquisition until the mid-1800s. There is still a formal body of Inquisition checking out those people who converted and were not properly practicing their Christianity. How active they were, but they existed until 1821 and 1826, or respectively. Okay, the exiles, now we get to our issues. The exiles naturally resented the conversos. Throughout the 1500s and 1600s, thousands escaped Spain and tried to rejoin the Jewish communities. Now we get to our issue. So you're a Jew. You're one of the 200,000 who left. You leave penniless. You most likely buried someone along the way. Arrive in a new community, in a foreign country, in a language you don't speak, with nothing. There are no yeshivas set up. There are no schools. There are no mikvahs. You have to, like, basically start from scratch. And then 20 years later, after your family is in shambles, trying to rebuild whatever it is that you have, someone shows up in a nice fancy car with a moving truck and all of their things, and they say, I made it out. I've been stuck in Spain for the last 25 years. I converted on that terrible Tisha B'Av in 1492. Horrible day, I remember it well. And now, it took me a while to get my papers in order and to sell my business. And Baruch Hashem, I made it out, and I'm so excited to join you here in this new place in Morocco, or in wherever they ended up. And the Jewish community there did not necessarily welcome them with open arms. And despite the fact that the Rabbanim, we have records over and over again saying, they're back. They want to be Jewish. Accept them. Not so simple. It's not so simple. This doesn't even need the explanation, but just as an example, I remember Rivki told me when she was growing up in her community in West Orange, there was one of her kids' fathers, when he was younger, 20 years earlier, had a brother who was in the Vietnam War, who was enlisted. And as you're all familiar, there was a phenomena here in the United States called draft dodging. And the yeshivas became filled with people who were learning because they didn't want to go fight in Vietnam for whatever reasons. Well, many they didn't find it was their war. They didn't want to die in a bloodbath. So they found whatever loopholes existed. And so this one family had a son who felt, I'm living here in America. It's my American duty. And he went to fight. He was killed. And so this family is now broken. This family has, you know, he was a 19 years old, 20 years old. All of his friends went off to yeshiva or university, whatever they did to get away from it. And he comes back in a coffin. 2 years later, when these boys, his colleagues, were 21, 22 and getting married, and they send an invitation to the family of the young man who was killed. And so the family was like, you want me to dance at your son's? Well, I'm so happy for you. How could you ask me to come? Now, this is not like a platoon of guys and one guy survived and one guy didn't. It's you avoided the situation that my son did the right thing and he didn't come home. And you didn't. How do you want me to dance? I can't. Now, this is part of what's going on in Israel today. As we know, whether you do serve, you don't serve. But this was the entire Jewish world coming out of Spain. Those who left penniless, with many graves unmarked along the way. And then someone shows up after having sold their business, surviving for the 20 years, pretending to be a Christian, and then says, take me back. And it wasn't so simple. And when we talk about like a great controversy, the shilas that are going to be asked for the next 300 years, the extent, we're going to take a look at some of them, we'll just go through some of the questions, and you see the pain of a fractured world. Let's take a look at some of the questions just to express what this is. By the way, the letter Samach Tet, which follow a lot of Sephardic name, Sephardi Tahor. Because if I'm a family that left, who do I want to marry my children off to? Someone who became a Christian for 5 years. Not in my family. We don't do that. And so the same idea of this pure Sephardi worked its way in the sense of you left. Don't come back and ask for Mafter Yona after you were in church for the last 5 years. Look at some of these questions.
How many of those who were converted left again to go there?
So we don't know the numbers. I don't have exact numbers. I don't know. But again, we're talking about a masses of like 200,000 who converted. So I'm sure there were some who stayed for a little bit and got out when they could. But these are, look at this question. We'll just look at the first couple of them. A woman obtained a get. Both she and her husband were Maranas. This is asked of the Rivash. Look at the years he lived in. This is 1326 to 40. This is before they were kicked out. And this question is already asked. She and her husband were Maranas, which means they already had converted because it was so bad in the mid-1300s. She converted because they couldn't survive, but they were secretly maintaining themselves as Jews. Her husband divorces her, and they can't go to the Jewish basin to get a get because they're Christian. So they worked out a get amongst their own community. So Jews, who were secretly Jews, signed the get. And her husband, on the outside, everybody's a Christian. The woman is a Christian. The husband divorcing her is a Christian. The two people who signed the get are Christian. And they're all claiming, but we're Jews. She then is able to get out of the land of Shemat. She gets out of Spain and came to the Arab lands to worship God in freedom. Even just saying those words is hilarious today, right? She left the land of Shemat, the Christian lands, and was able to successfully run to an Arab land where she can serve her God in freedom without fear. She says the witnesses were known to observe the Torah, but because of many reasons they were unable to leave. They're still stuck in Spain. Now, do we consider these Maranos transgressors and as such invalid witnesses? Or do we let her remarry? She wants to remarry. She shows up in your city in France. She wants to remarry. She has a suitor who wants to marry her. What's the problem? We know that she was once married. Her husband is still in Spain. There's no email. There's no texting. He's stuck in Spain. The two people who signed the get are in Spain. If we accept the get and we let her remarry, but it's really not valid, we've just created some serious mamzer problem. She's not like she's a married woman. Or do we accept the get? There's no one to go. Like, he can't give it again. Do you accept witnesses who are known Christians, but in secret maintain their identity as Jews? Are they a valid witness on a get to allow this woman to remarry? You are the Beis Din in England who have to make this decision as to can she or can she not remarry. This is already asked in the mid-1300s, this question. Yeah, they were kicked out. Yeah, wherever they ended up, yeah. Just choose your other place where they were able to stay for a while.
Is the last line relevant?
Yes, I lost the money. That's the claim. In other words, well, they stayed there because they needed the money. They needed to survive. That was the only way that they could live. Two brothers. Look at the next question. Avram and Ephraim. They live in the city of, I'm sure that's not pronounced oven, but that's how it's spelled. Their father, formerly known as Shner, renounced his faith and converted to Christianity. So we have two guys in town, two guys in shul. Young kids, let's call them 20, 22-year-olds. They're off in university. And meanwhile, while they're off in school, or their father becomes, he can't take it anymore, and he leaves the faith and he joins the local church. Since the day of his conversion, the father, his decent and upright sons, have not been called up to the reading of the Torah. They have not gotten an aliyah. Not because the shul won't give it to them, because they refused it. Why do they refuse an aliyah? Because they're ashamed. Because what's the halacha if a man, a person, has his father convert out of Judaism to become a Christian? We now call him up by the grandfather's name. So these two young kids, Ephraim and Avram, bad enough, they can't go home for Shabbos. It's bad enough, they don't have a place to go. Their father converted, their father's going to church. So they say to the gabbai, don't call us up by our grandfather's name. That's like, it's so human. Everybody in shul knows us as Ephraim ben Shner, Avram ben Shner. Now you're going to call us up Avram ben Shlomo, our grandfather. It's humiliating. Like, leave it alone. Just call us up by our father's name. We've been through enough. Can't you just leave it the way we've been called up our whole life? The gabbai says, Shner? The guy who's been at our shul for 30 years, we went to all of his simchas, he came to our simchas, and now he's in the church next door. We all lost our businesses, and he's sitting pretty. You want me to mention Schneer's name in my shul? I will not. The kid said, can't cut us a break. Like, just call us up by the... So he's got no aliyah, because the gabbai won't mention Schneer's name. And the sons say, please, don't call us up by our grandfather's name. So they come to you as the Rav. What should we do? You hear the Shilas? New, what would you do in that case? So the Maram Padua said, tell the gabbai to deal with it. You know, but you can understand a gabbai. But they said to the gabbai, he said, you call him up by, you call him Shner. How about this? The testimony of a former Marano regarding events that occurred while he was a Marano, acceptable in a Beis Din. So a guy gets out of Spain, and he arrives in whatever country he arrives in North Africa, and a case comes up which involved testimony from 10 years prior from when he was still in Spain, and he knew some information, and they bring him into Beis Din. You know so-and-so. You know that I gave him a loan. Yeah, you were there. He says, yeah, I was there. Yeah, but you were practicing guy at the time. You were a Christian. He says, I know, but I was forced to because I was there, but now I'm here in North Africa. I'm a Jew again. Would you as a Beis Din accept the testimony of a guy who's now practicing in shul, but for 10 years prior, he was in church, a Mechal Shabbos, eating on Yom Kippur to maintain his identity.
Is that the issue, that he's Mechal Shabbos, that he's unreliable?
All of that, right? A guy who did all of that, who knew about the loan, who's brought in by somebody, and the Beis Din says, you know, what do we do? Do we believe him or do we not believe him? Does he have the ne'manus? You know, okay, maybe you were forced, but are you a reliable testimony that we can accept when you're testifying about something that took place while you were Christian?
If he was an absent Christian without a converso, would it be an acceptable testimony?
Okay, excellent. What about a question, a regular person, a person who converts, a Christian his whole life, converts, and then once is it called upon to testify about something that had happened while he was a Christian?
I'm still Christian.
I mean, he's still a Christian. And on that question, we would say no. In a Beis Din, we wouldn't accept it. But what about, let's take that, let's say he converted, and now he's testifying about something that had happened while he was a Christian. That's definitely discussed, and I don't remember. I'm not sure. But here we have a case of a guy who was claiming to be a Jew the whole time, But on the outside, he was a practicing Christian. How about this next one? Skip over to... Oh, no, the bottom one on page four. The fourth one on page four. 15 years ago, this is, look at the date of the Rav, the Lechem Rav. So he lived between 1545 and 1588, where he's answering these shadows. So it's somewhere in, that probably wasn't the year, those are the years of his shuvah, those are the years he lived. So it's the mid-50s, this is 60 years after the Inquisition. A fellow named Yaakov renounces his Judaism and converts to Christianity. And then he immediately regrets it and repents, and he can't believe that he was so weak, and he can't believe that he did it. He keeps his face covered for 15 years as a sign of remorse. He's steadfast. He feels terrible that he can't believe he did it. Okay, and now the shaila is, he moves to a town, and he wants to be the chazan or a shochet. About tshuva. Now, halachically, the shaila is like this. There's a specific area about a Kohen duchening. Once a Kohen practices idolatry anytime, ever, even once, he's forever disqualified from serving as a Kohen. He's not allowed to duchen. But that's a Kohen and duchening. You can't be the source of bracha, that Hashem should give bracha through you, if at any point you practice idolatry. But this is not a shaila of a Kohen. This is a shaila of a shochet. So the community says, no way. You want us to eat your meat? You're the shochet? You, he says, it was only for a couple of weeks until I felt so terrible. I said, you gave in and you became a Christian and now you come back to our community and you want to be the shochet? No way. Or, he says, I have yahrzeit for my father. I'd like to daven. So the tzibur says, you're going to lead us in nikadesh ha-shimcha ba'olam, that your name should be sanctified. Kadosh, kadosh, kadosh. I don't care that you have yahrzeit for your father. You're not. You want to sit in shul? Okay, I don't like it, but the Rav told me I have to let you come. You want to daven and be the chazan?
So there's a difference between a machal shabbos and someone who chazan and someone who actually practiced Christianity.
Correct. In other words, and in halacha, there would be no difference. You want to? You ask the rabbanim, they said, he's a chazer b'tshuva, he's a chazer b'tshuva. Chazer b'tshuva.
So there is no difference in...
Not on that. If he's
not tainted, only
Kohen. Only Kohen for duchening or for anything in the Beis HaMikdash. He's officially in halacha tainted. So in other words, so here again, what I'm pointing out is there's a halachic answer and then there's the guy sitting in shul who did lose a grandparent on the way out, who lost their business, who left penniless, who suffered through all of everything that they suffered through, came to a new community, built it up, and this guy rides in and says, I have yahrzeit for my father, I'd like to daven.
So the question is, he qualifies? The answer is yes.
Correct. But is the controversy, so to speak, the tension was, the kehila would often said, go find yourself another minion. And then you had a minion of conversos who would say, you know, this one shunned me, that one shunned me, so make our own minion. You know, Jews know how to make their own minion, right? So you have a minion of conversos, so that in the new world that they were creating, very often because of that tension, would then create a little sub-community within it. This maintains itself. In Atlanta, Georgia, I had three different couples came over my 15 years there, Spanish-speaking couples, who eventually got out of Spain and ended up in South America, who all claimed, they all wanted to convert, and they all claimed they came from converso descendants, and they all had the same story of candlesticks in a closet, and a talis, and burning fingernails, and not eating pork. They had like this list of bizarre, in their minds, they're like, we never understood it, and then all of a sudden we discovered Jews. This is in 2015. You know, 600 years after the Inquisition, there are still pockets of people who, like, don't know anything about Judaism and suddenly come across and they're like, oh, that's why we always did. Like, it just was passed on in our family for 500 years. We want to become Jewish. We have these candlesticks that my grandmother said, keep these here. And they just... You know, there's still, you can look them up today. There's a group called the Society of Crypto-Judaic Studies. And it is a society, they have yearly conferences. They have, this last one was in El Paso, in which those descended from crypto-Jews still get together once a year. They have conferences. It's for study and for information. But the ramifications, the reverberations throughout Jewish history of this time period literally still today continue to manifest themselves.
So, Rabbi, we know why the Jews of Spain and Portugal were called Sephardim. At what point did the Jews that were already living in Arab lands also take on being called Sephardim?
I don't know. I don't know if it was influenced from all these Jews that eventually made their way there, or...
The Ladino Jews call Jews Sephardim who live in, like, Syria. They call them Arabs. They don't call them Sephardim.
I thought they called them Edot HaMizrach, honestly, to differentiate to the ones who live east, because most of Sephardim lived west of Israel. But Iraq, Iran,
right,
Syria,
they're on the other side.
But the Latinos,
those were always...
Remembering also that after this expulsion, there were no Sephardic Jews left in Spain and Portugal. They all take up residence in other countries. So that's where you now have this new mixture of all of those true Sephardim from the lands of Sfarad. There are no longer. They're all gone and settled in all these other places. There was a ban. The rabbis put a ban on going to Spain, a 500-year ban from 1492 on a Jew visiting Spain. Not everybody observed it, but it was in 1992, right? The 500-year ban was up, and it was like a whole slew of Jews who cared, who said, "I'm not going back to Spain," who went back. But this influenced so many aspects of Jewish history.
I've been looking up in Spain, it was that 500-year ban, but then they did it in the 1990s.
They what?
In 1992.
Right, that's when they opened up. Chabad went, because there was this...
Before 1992, they did not, because they observed the
500-year ban. There was a 500-year ban.
Wasn't there.
There you go. There was such a thing that the Rabbanim said, you know, don't go back to Spain, and they didn't. But it's a massive part of our history. It's a massive trauma. Again, had it not been for Holocaust, it would still be addressed as the biggest trauma. And how there were so many people converted, those who did not, who pretended to, and then how we dealt with them when they came back was super complicated. That's the reality. It was a super complicated thing which continues to manifest itself. All right, we'll continue with some other topics as we go along. Have a great night, everyone.